As we've shown over the last two seasons of Taiwan Salon, Taiwan has many qualities with the potential to attract others and gain international support. Yet, Taiwan continues to struggle with communicating these strengths to international audiences. For a season two finale, we are joined by Dr. Gary Ronsley and Diana Jawen Lee to discuss the role of media and creative industries in promoting Taiwan's soft power resources. So, let's get into it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Taiwan Salon, the Global Taiwan Institute's Cultural Policy and Soft Power Podcast. My name is Adrian Wu, the host of Taiwan Salon, and a research associate at GTI. Today, we are joined by Dr. Gary Ronsley and Diana Jawen Lee. Gary Ronsley is a professor of public diplomacy and the head of University of Lincoln School of Social and Political Sciences. He has written extensively on soft power, international communications, and public diplomacy in Taiwan. Diana Jawen Lee is a documentary filmmaker and award-winning independent film producer who has worked in the United States, Taiwan, and other Asian countries. In addition to her work as a creator, she is also an experienced media arts administrator with over 15 years of nonprofit and media arts organizational management experience. Okay, so Diana and Gary, thank you so much for joining us today. So I'd like to begin with a somewhat broad question. In your opinion, what do you think are Taiwan's soft power resources?
Okay, so I'll kick off with this one then. Thank you very much, Adrienne, for that question. Well, for me, I think that Taiwan has considerable number of soft power resources. Unlike more mainstream approaches to the subject of soft power, I don't think that culture plays as important a role as some writers think that it does. That's not surprising, given that I'm a political scientist who's coming to this from a background looking at politics and international relations. For me, soft power, and power, you know, has that kind of political connotation to it. Taiwan's soft power for me is rooted in the fact that it is a very successful, vibrant, liberal democracy, that it has, you know, very successful transfers of power between parties and elections. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in January and whether there is a transfer of power there or not, which will be, you know, throwing up its own questions. There is no transfer of power. But certainly, I think the fact that it is a vibrant, successful democracy is the very source of Taiwan's soft power. It's autonomous civil society. It's a safe space for people to feel that they can criticize or protest. The way that Taiwan has led on LGBTQ issues in the region, its handling of the COVID pandemic. I think there are all kinds of examples that can be used to show that because Taiwan is a democracy, that it has considerable soft power in contrast to, obviously, its nearest neighbor.
I definitely agree that democracy is its best and most touted, I guess, soft power. Because I'm a filmmaker, so I feel like you can't really have a vibrant and diverse society or culture without democracy. So I think, you know, of course, culture piggybacks off of democracy. But I do think that using Taiwanese culture, using, you know, obviously also the media to advance Taiwan's democracy, that's part and parcel to, you know, to the soft power, I think.
Actually, I do have a question on that, which I've gotten quite a bit. Can you separate the political culture and the civil society from Taiwanese culture? Does that overlap? Is it kind of the same thing? Does it overweave? Because to me, I feel like the political culture is also part of Taiwanese culture. So it kind of comes together. But what would your thoughts be on that?
I mean, I think I'll take a stab at it. I think it is hard to differentiate or to separate Taiwan's political climate and Taiwan's political identity with Taiwanese culture. I think that gets conflated, though. I don't think they're necessarily two sides of the same coin. I do think that it gets conflated. And I think when people, because, you know, Taiwanese political identity and Taiwan's current political climate or its, you know, political history, I think is so much tied to Taiwanese identity. So I think it's kind of unavoidable when you're talking about, oh, what is Taiwanese culture? It's kind of unavoidable to not talk about politics, you know, especially if you ask people, like if you just walk down the street and take a poll and you say, what is Taiwanese culture? People will inevitably talk about its politics. So I think that's just, yeah, I think it's just something that's hard to parcel out.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it depends which kind of audiences that you're talking about here, because obviously I'm you know, very interested in international audiences and the way that Taiwan is perceived and communicated to international audiences. And I think the problem for me is whether you're looking at Taiwan's politics or its culture, people in the kind of parts of the world where, you know, knowing about Taiwan is important are simply just not familiar with Taiwan. You know, if I walk down the street here in Lincoln in the UK and ask people about Taiwan, they're probably not going to know very much at all, if anything, because it's just not a high profile country. It's not a high profile story here at all. So I think that that's why, you know, I always say that Taiwan's public diplomacy has a lot of work to do if it is targeting, you know, the ordinary Joe on the street of these countries. So I think that politics is one thing, because if there is a sudden story about Taiwan, you know, we had, I mean, even the typhoon last week made BBC news here on the radio, at least. But unless there is, you know, military tension in the Taiwan Strait, whether there's going to be a lot of coverage probably of the election, whether there's an earthquake or something, Taiwan is not on the news agenda. And that's not surprising at all. But for culture, it's an even tougher sell, I think, because, you know, if you say to people, what is Taiwan culture? I don't think they're going to know very much either, and how it's different from Chinese culture, if it is different from Chinese culture. So I think it's a really tough sell. And this is part of the problem, I think, with putting culture with soft power, is that if you're using those cultural products as a tool of soft power, and there's no reason why you should be, because culture is culture, and is cultural in its own right and doing its own thing. But if you're expecting it to have soft power implications, there's a whole piece of work that needs to be done around that to talk about the narratives of that cultural product. You know, so for example, I had this conversation a few years ago with the Ministry of Culture in Taiwan, where they told me that one of the great things that they were going to be doing is sending around the world exhibitions of traditional Chinese characters, and that somehow this was going to inspire people about Taiwan. And I had to say to them, why are you doing this? It tells you nothing about Taiwan whatsoever. Most people don't know the difference between traditional characters, simplified characters. So I think that there is sometimes an emphasis on projecting culture as if just simply putting something out there is going to make people understand the country, it's going to familiarize them or whatever, when I think that there is much more work to be done to show, well, actually, you know, this cultural product comes from this place, and all of this other stuff is happening as well. It has to be part of a bigger package, I think.
So I guess the next question really links up with that. So what is the best way of projecting and communicating Taiwan's soft power, you know, in whatever form you kind of think of it to mean, and its story to an international audience?
As a filmmaker and as a film producer, I think, you know, for me, that's definitely something that I've been grappling with. And I think it's an interesting process, because I've only been working in Taiwan for the last 10 years. And I've worked with probably 10 to 15 filmmakers so far. You know, and they come from very diverse backgrounds, educational backgrounds, and class, gender. And I think when, you know, like I was saying, when you ask people on the street and you take a pulse of what is Taiwanese or what is Taiwanese culture, I think you'll get, you know, from working with 10, 15 different filmmakers, I get 10, 15 different answers. So even just telling stories, I think, has been quite an interesting process to really think about, you know, what is the story that you want to tell about Taiwan and about this place and this country. There's just not a, interestingly, there's not a unifying voice, but I think that's also what makes Taiwan so interesting at this point in time, is that Taiwan is so diverse and there's so many different voices that are now surfacing, and people are finding ways to tell their stories that are not, you know, because as most of your audiences or listeners will know, Taiwan was under martial law for a long time, and the free press is still considerably new, right, in comparison to other democratic societies or democratic nations. So in terms of like, how do you use media as a tool to tell stories, to reach audiences, and to convey like national identity or politics, I think the filmmakers I work with are still trying to find that voice and trying to find their place in the world, and it has been challenging. And even going back to what Gary was just saying about, you know, the Ministry of Culture wanting to, you know, introduce Chinese traditional writings to the world, you know, that also is something like, you know, so who's dictating what gets said, and who has access to tools and resources to tell their stories? That's an ongoing thing that I'm finding really, it's still evolving here in Taiwan, and it's frustrating and fascinating at the same time. And, you know, we're really in a really interesting place to really think about, you know, for Taiwanese people to really think about, you know, what is the story we want to tell, and how do we tell them, you know, and what kind of access and tools do we have at our disposal to tell those stories. So I don't know if that actually answers your question, but I think it's an ongoing process, you know, to think about like, how do we tell our stories, and who's our audience, and what are we trying to say, and is there a cohesive, unified voice, which, you know, there isn't. So,
yeah, I mean, I would agree entirely with what Diana has said there, and even as a political scientist, I do recognize, you know, the connections between politics and culture, and I've written extensively on cultural diplomacy and recognize the power of culture. But I think that in Taiwan, that, you know, there is the added problem, as Diana alluded to, as who gets to decide the narrative, who gets to decide what is Taiwan, what is Taiwan's culture. And that itself is very contentious in Taiwan, perhaps more than many other places, because of the political volatility, the island. I mean, for me, it's very clear, you know, the fact that Taiwan is a liberal democracy with this civil society space, with autonomous cultural industries, to me means that, okay, leave them alone. You know, government should not be interfering at all. And once you start saying government has to think about what soft power narratives its culture is telling, that's when you get onto dangerous ground, you know, because then it becomes, you know, a government narrative rather than culture for culture's sake, which can have a far greater impact on global audiences. So my advice always is leave the cultural industries alone, leave civil society alone, let them tell their own stories. Obviously, government has a role to play in providing the infrastructures and, you know, the investment in the, you know, we saw this in Korea with the investment in the creative industries and everything else. Government can play a supporting role. But I always get very nervous when government starts saying, right, what is our soft power strategy and how can we bring the cultural industries in to do this? Because it's just going to backfire. You're just going to get the situation as you do on the other side of the Taiwan Strait, where everything therefore is seen as propaganda because they know that it's embedded somehow in the state system. So that would be my answer to that. In terms of how to tell Taiwan's story, apart from that, I think the first question that needs to be addressed is, who is your audience? You know, because there is no way that you can just send out a message and hope that you're suddenly going to change global opinion about Taiwan. First of all, it's very difficult to move that needle of public opinion because of the political geostrategic situation that Taiwan is in. And no matter how much you send out messages, you know, America's not going to recognize Taiwan. It's not going to be a member of the United Nations. You know, it's not going to suddenly change in that sense. So that's one thing, recognizing the reality of the situation, but also recognizing that targeting the general public, for example, here in the UK, is probably not the best thing to do, because people are saying, well, so what? You know, where is Taiwan even? You know, but if you are targeting the political elite, if you're targeting influencers, journalists, teachers, you know, probably people are listening to this podcast because they have an interest in Taiwan. That's the kind of audience you need to be targeting as a public diplomat, rather than just believing that you can just, you know, target everybody and suddenly, you know, public opinion is going to change in Taiwan's favor. It's not.
As producers, when we, you know, when I was getting into the industry, and this was in the U.S., and I would go into to meet with investors and meet with distributors or funders or whatever, you know, one of the questions always inevitably would be asked is, who's your audience? And in the beginning, you know, when I was just starting out, I would say, everybody, we want everyone to see our film. And they're like, no, that's impossible. Like, get real. So, you know, and it's really been a process of really understanding who you're talking to. And yeah, of course, all the filmmakers, when they make their film, they want the whole world to see their film, but that's just not practical and it's not realistic. So yeah, we do need to think about, for Taiwan specifically, whether it's film, television, music, whatever kind of, you know, media or content, who is our audience? And I totally agree with what Gary is saying. You know, a lot of times when I make films, especially because I mostly make documentary films, I do think about who can I reach that will actually be able to use the information that we're providing the film in ways that would further their knowledge or help change or shape opinions. Because it's really hard. There's so much content out there, right? It's so hard to compete with the YouTubers, the influencers, you know, with K-pop, with K-drama, you know, there's just so much stuff out there that to think that a Taiwanese documentary film or a Taiwanese 10-minute piece on some person, you know, some historical figure is going to be seen by everyone, because yeah, at the end of the day, who cares? You know, so we really do have to be very strategic about who we're talking to. Yeah.
I suppose in terms of film and television, I think it's a very different environment now than it was, you know, even 15, 20 years ago. I mean, I remember going into a video store. Sorry for our younger listeners, a video store will sound like the Stone Age, but I remember going into a video store in the UK here and picking off the shelf a French film with subtitles. And the person who I was renting the film from said to me, "It's got subtitles." You know, as if I was renting a porn movie or something, you know, that was something I had to be ashamed of and cautious about, that I was renting a foreign film with subtitles. I think those days are gone now. And I think that certainly here in the UK, there is much more of an appetite to be watching films and TV series from different parts of the world. It's extraordinary the number of international productions we are seeing, not just on streaming services in the UK, but on mainstream television as well. You know, and my Netflix, my Amazon is just full of, you know, movies and series from all over the world. And of course, everybody's still talking about Squid Games, you know, from Korea. And, you know, so I think that there is more of an appetite than there used to be for international television programming, which is good in a sense because it gets people interested. It gives them a taste of something, you know. But at the same time, I've been to so many conferences which have been talking about soft power, film, cinema, and these kind of things. And particularly in China's case, there is still this assumption that all we have to do is produce films and somehow it's going to, you know, have these audiences. And I have to explain to them, no, because, you know, certainly in cinema releases, films are still shown in film festivals or in art cinemas, or, you know, they're not still, you're not seeing the international movies in, you know, the showcase, the multiplexes and everything else. So there's still that niche audience there. But if you're turning to streaming in particular, I think that there is more of an appetite now. So there is a lot of opportunities, I think, that there weren't before to get these international cultural products the exposure that they deserve.
Now that there's an MOU between Taiwan and Netflix, I found that that has been a really great way for Taiwanese productions to get onto Netflix. But at the same time, when I talk to people and tell them, like, oh, did you know that this Taiwanese production is on Netflix? They've never heard of it. So it is nice that there's more access, but at the same time, there is so much more competition. So I guess it kind of cuts both ways, right? Where now they're able to get their message out, but there's so many more competing messages too.
Oh yeah, but I would argue, you know, that the fact that, you know, people don't know that there are these Taiwanese programmings on Netflix, if you compare that to something like Squid Games, you know, Korea made a huge thing about the success of this program and the way that it was being shown all over the world. I haven't really seen anything comparable from Taiwan at all to say, look, we're on Netflix, we've got these great programs, you know. There's been nothing. It's just very, very quiet. You know, that's been very typical of Taiwan in its whole public diplomacy over the past, you know, 20 or 30 years or so. So I think that having it there is one thing, and that's a great thing. And at the same time, there has to be more of a concerted effort to say, look, we're here, you know, hello, please watch us.
And I can just add too to that is, you know, when we working in the film industry, I think whenever we hear or see like any of these MOUs, whether it's with Taiwan and Netflix or whether it's Taiwan with, you know, other Asian countries, which there's been a few as well, the access and the resources actually, they don't get trickled down. Right. So the government and this is goes back to what Gary was saying about, you know, the government needs to just get out of the way because they're actually being the gatekeepers of what gets seen. And so there isn't, you know, this it's not so transparent how they're looking for projects or how they're looking for filmmakers to work with in Taiwan, or what kind of content they're looking for, that process isn't so transparent. So they're deciding what kind of stories get told or which filmmakers will get access to funding or to, you know, the production budget, to the production funds, and which actors will be in which shows or which programs. So I think it's, you know, I find that's really problematic. And that's something that I think is still, you know, there's still the government's hands are still in every part of civil society. And they're still interfering a lot in the decisions that get made in the media. So it's frustrating because we do see a lot of these MOUs get signed. But, you know, as filmmakers who are, you know, just making content, we're not really sure how this affects us or how we can get a piece of that, you know. And yeah, and it's not a very transparent process.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I know that when I was looking into Taika and kind of the co-funding programs, I saw that one of the factors that they will try to determine whether or not they take on a project is like Taiwanese-ness. And like looking into like how Taiwanese the story is and the cast. And I'm like, well, what does this really mean? Like, do you have certain factors that you look into that it's like it has to have this like XYZ? Or is it just like, oh, it takes place in Taiwan, the country, like, so that's enough. Or, you know, these are Taiwanese people, so that's enough. Like, is there a certain version of Taiwanese-ness that they are kind of applying? Or is it just to kind of... it's actually more broad than that. So I found it very difficult to understand. And I was very curious about how they kind of apply these types of guidelines.
Yeah, I think that's also very arbitrary because, you know, there are also local grants, like the Taipei Film Commission, or, you know, like the local Taoyuan Film Grant or the local Taichung Film Grant. And it's the same thing. They don't require you to just film there. They also require you to somehow promote, in quotes, promote the city or the township. And it's unclear what specifically that means. You know, how does one promote that? You know, and like, what are you supposed to do? Policies like that, I think, they're very stifling, and they actually are a disservice to creatives and to filmmakers, because we find ourselves needing to, in order to get funding, we find ourselves needing to actually write into our scripts or write into our proposals elements that are irrelevant to our film in order to get funding. Because at the end of the day, you need to get funding from, you know, wherever it is that you're filming or shooting before you can seek international co-production funds, you know, in terms of how we, you know, try to raise our monies for our film. So in order for you to get funding from your home country, let's say Taiwan, for example, you have to, like, there are always these requirements of like Taiwanese-ness or something about the local environment that you have to kind of prove that you're servicing in order to get the funds. And that's just something that I also have been, you know, been working here for the last 10 years. I also find just really bizarre and troubling. And again, it's a policy that I just don't understand, but I think a lot of filmmakers have become so used to it that they'll just make stuff up and you kind of have to in order to get the funds. And it's, you know, it's a really, yeah, it's a bad policy. I don't even know what that's about.
Yeah. I mean, that's fascinating, Diana, because I didn't know any of that. So that's great. You know, that's really interesting to hear that perspective. And I think you're absolutely right. For me, it sounds like what's happening is that, you know, in a way, it's treating your audience like idiots. You know, that they can't understand the film because it's a film. You know, they can't understand that it's possibly local or local stories or whatever. You have to shoehorn these messages in. And once you start shoehorning messages into films, the credibility of the cultural product, whatever it is, goes down. You know, this is classic propaganda. You know, the more you try to shoehorn messages into a cultural product, the more suspicious becomes the audience and you lose credibility. You know, it's far better, as I said, and Diana agrees, is just to, you know, let the cultural industries do their thing, be creative. I mean, if you take something like, I know I keep going back to Squid Games, but if you take something like Squid Games, you know, that could be from anywhere. There's nothing Korean in there whatsoever, really. You know, when you watch it, it's an innovative story. It's creative. It's very well made with high production values, with good acting and a good script. And as I said, it's a very original concept. That's what's selling it. It's not the fact that it's Korean or that it takes place in a particular part of Korea or whatsoever. You know, the audiences can get that through other ways. But the first and foremost thing is it a good product that is going to grip your audience? And then everything follows from that. Once you start shoehorning in messages, that's when you start to lose it.
I'll kind of skip a few questions here because I think we kind of covered a lot of things that I wanted to go into. So actually, I'm going to just skip straight into Taiwan Plus, especially since we're talking about the government and how that interacts with media. So during its launch, Taiwan Plus was billed as a way of telling Taiwan's story to the world. But could you talk about what kind of role that you think Taiwan Plus should play?
Okay. Well, I like it. And the reason I like it is because it is something new for Taiwan. It seems that they are finally getting the message that they have to be doing something to be telling Taiwan's story and news to the world or whatever. So it has its flaws. And I think Diana is not a fan of Taiwan Plus. I'm interested to hear your views on this. But for me, just from the sense of having that platform, I think demonstrates that there is some progress in the way that Taiwan is selling itself. I mean, I've always, you know, in previous publications over the past 15, 20 years, I've always said Taiwan has a lot of soft power, but no public diplomacy, because it's had real problems selling itself and the mechanisms are not there. It's more difficult for me to make that claim now. And I think that Taiwan Plus is a step in the right direction. But again, you're not talking to the world. You are talking to people who are interested in Taiwan and will actively seek out that platform and that information. So I think any claims, it's talking to the world. If I can just give you an example of this, I remember when I went to visit CCTV in China, in Beijing. And, you know, of course, they are making claims that they have millions and millions of viewers all around the world, and they have advertisements where you're in the Sahara Desert and people are checking CGTN, you know, to see what's happening in the news or whatever. And I had to explain to them, that's not the case. You know, what you have are whatever millions it is, that's the possible audience, because they may be included in a satellite package, you know, or a cable package or whatever. That's the potential audience. But the actual audience isn't going to be that big. So I think that any attempt by any broadcaster around the world to speak to the world, they need a wake-up call and say, well, no, it's not the world. It's a particular audience who are interested, who are tuning in, who are already, you know, are familiar with that platform, whatever. So I think, as I said before, changing world opinion through these kind of initiatives is going to be very, very difficult, if impossible.
I think Taiwan Plus, I mean, I think it's good that there's another platform for Taiwan to speak to the international audience through. Speaking from a filmmaker and a producer's perspective, I think Taiwan Plus is yet another way that the government is trying to dictate what gets shown, what gets funded, what gets greenlit, how filmmakers should tell their stories, and who has access to tell these stories, or who has the right to tell stories. And I think it's problematic, because it's kind of it's a continuation of the current kind of funding and distribution and content creation environment that Taiwanese filmmakers and media makers are in, except now it's in English. So I don't see this as, you know, in terms of for filmmakers, I don't see this as an improvement in the situation. I just see this as we have this one pie, you know, where all of our funding and resources are coming from. And now it's just, you know, now there's just another government, you know, arm or government apparatus that's trying to carve out another piece of the pie and dictating how to use this resource. And I'm sure it's still evolving as an organization. And I think they're still looking to see how to best reach audiences, how to best program, how to best curate their content, how to best work with filmmakers and content creators. But I think so far, I find their process problematic. And I've had conversations with them. I've pitched to them. Also, I don't know if this is going to get me in trouble, but, you know, a lot of times filmmakers, when we're making our films and we're telling our stories, we also think about copyright, right? Like, it's very important for us to have ownership over the stories we tell. And it's also very important for us to think about the audiences we want to reach and the impact we want to make. And a lot of these companies, Taiwan Plus included, and any company that's funded by the government, they take away that right. So I think that's, you know, again, that's really problematic. And that's something that a lot of Taiwanese filmmakers have had to deal with for you know, forever. And Taiwan Plus now coming in to this space, now they're just adding another layer into, you know, the rights and ownership, and they're another piece of the problem, essentially. So I think for filmmakers, it's not really clear, you know, whether this is better and more access for us and whether this is really going to help us in getting our films out there and help us reach a wider audience, or if this is just going to take away our rights and take away our ability to tell stories the way we want to tell them and who we want to tell them to.
Although Gary and Diana praised Taiwan Plus for its potential in reaching an English-speaking international audience, they also raised concerns over the lack of direction for the platform and a lack of clarity over what the platform wanted to be, a problem which I also encountered when I was writing about Taiwan Plus for our Global Taiwan Brief.
You know, one of the best pieces of advice that my PhD supervisor gave me whenever I'm starting a new piece of research about propaganda or looking at strategic communications in some ways, just follow the money. You know, who is funding this? Where's the money coming from? And I think that's always a good indication of these kind of activities and the intentions and, you know, the motivations around them. And I think that one thing about Taiwan Plus is that I'm still not clear of the model that it's following. You know, if you look around the world at these kind of organizations, these kind of platforms, not just recently on social media, but going right back to shortwave radio days, you know, you have these different models. You have models that are official channels. So you've got your CGTNs, you've got your Voices of America, for example, Radio Free Asia, those kind of things. And then you've got those that are representing the country, but tend to be independent, like the BBC World Service, which has a huge audience around the world because of its credibility. And then you have these news organizations which are completely independent, don't follow an agenda, like CNN or whatever, and are considered to be international news organizations engaging in public diplomacy, but they're not part of that kind of government public diplomacy apparatus. And I think for me, the question is, I'm still not sure where Taiwan Plus sits in this. Is it trying to be, you know, a news organization like, you know, CNN, BBC or whatever? Is it supposed to be a mixture of culture and news, you know, in which case, you know, there's, you know, CGTN has a lot of news in culture on its programming. So I think it just needs a bit more time to sort out what its intentions are. And once they have that, then it will be very clear. You know, if you say, look, we are a government-run platform for Taiwan's official public diplomacy, fair enough. It's one platform, it's one channel that can get that out there, and that's fine. But if they start, you know, thinking about, well, we are not an official public diplomacy channel and we want to do all these other things and bring in, you know, the creative industries and these kind of things, then it becomes much more murky. And that's where the confusion comes. So I think it just has to have a clearer identity and a clearer idea of its intention. And that will help, you know, solve a lot of those problems, I think.
I think also one of the challenging things with Taiwan's, with a lot of these media companies in Taiwan, like Gary was saying, is the funding, you know, follow the money. And if we, as far as I know, Taiwan Plus is currently 100% funded by the government. They were under CNA for some time, and then there was, I don't really know what the process is called, but basically PTS, Taiwan's Public Television, took over the management of it. So now they're under PTS. But I'm pretty sure most of the funding still comes from the government, which is taxpayers' money. But essentially, it's you know, the Taiwanese government. And I think that the tricky thing, too, with that is this was going back to how this is all gets conflated with politics, is it's under the DPP, right? Like, so Taiwan Plus was founded under the DPP or the Taiwan administration. And there's confusion about, you know, like Gary was saying, are you supposed to serve the government? Are you supposed to be a government's mouthpiece? If so, then it's for the DPP party or the Taiwan administration. Well, what will happen after the election? Does that, you know, where will Taiwan Plus dissolve? Like, where, who is supposed to serve then, and what will be its agenda? So I think in theory, it's great that there is a news organization or a new media outfit that's, you know, in English and that's, you know, trying to speak to an international audience and, you know, have English content. But yeah, I agree. It's unclear to me what their agenda is ultimately, and how will they work with the film industry or the media industry on a larger level, and how will they differ from PTS and what PTS is doing, aside from the English speaking aspect of it. So I think there's still a lot that is unclear. And I think right now filmmakers, they're actually very proactive in wanting to collaborate with filmmakers. But I think filmmakers for the most part are suspicious, and rightly so. And, you know, and I think a lot of filmmakers are also still waiting to see exactly what their agenda is before deciding on, you know, whether we want to work with them, and what kind of relationship do we want to develop with Taiwan Plus? Because again, it goes back to ownership of, you know, the products we create, and ultimately who has the right to decide, you know, when our films get seen, who gets to see it, and who ultimately has copyright over it. I think a lot of that's still very unclear.
If I can just jump in on something that Diana said there, because it sparked something in me when I was listening to it about the change of governments in Taiwan, and I just wanted to think about the way that was also impacting on public diplomacy, soft power, because what we see is that, you know, although I said right at the beginning, you know, the transfer of power is a wonderful thing, and you've got the liberal democracy and everything else, but when the message is changing every 4 or 8 years, that becomes a problem, you know. And I think that what we have seen, certainly since, you know, 1996 with the first presidential election in Taiwan, is that the public diplomacy, cultural diplomacy, soft power, it all changes every 4 or 8 years. So the messaging is very inconsistent. And soft power works best in the long term. You know, you have to build up trust, credibility. You have to build up your audiences so that they become familiar with the brand, you know, and all of these things. And if you're switching your message every 4 years, you know, you can tinker with things, of course, according to your policies, and you can tinker with the institutional arrangements. You know, that happens everywhere. But if you look at other places around the world, you know, the UK, the US, in essence, the messaging remains the same about the core values, about what we represent and everything else. That tends not to be the case in Taiwan, you know, that the shifts every 4 years or so. You know, I mean, even something very simple, like, you know, the Ministry of Tourism changing Taiwan Touch Your Heart to Taiwan the Heart of Asia, which was absolute nonsense. And I my head was in my hands. I was pulling my hair out at this when I was talking to them, because I said, when I'm in London and places now, I am seeing Taiwan Touch Your Heart everywhere. And that message says everything you need to know about Taiwan. You know, Taiwan is a friendly place. It's warm. It's emotional. You had your own theme song, you know, Ila Formosa, Taiwan Touch Your Heart on the air. That was a great brand. And then suddenly it changes. Taiwan, the heart of Asia. What does that mean? You know, every country in Asia says it's the heart of Asia. Malaysia, truly Asia. You know, I mean, it doesn't mean anything. Whereas as Taiwan Touch Your Heart really sold a message, I think, about Taiwan. And I won't give you all the details of their responses and things and the way that they answered this, because it was just nonsense. It was crazy. But nevertheless, that's an example of how, you know, how things can change, and you're destroying a brand, when, and especially for Taiwan, where people are unfamiliar with it anyway, you know, and then you just change it overnight. You know, you're changing the slogans and the branding when it takes time. It takes time to build up that brand. Regardless of which government is in power, the kind of core messages have to remain. There has to be that consistency. Otherwise, you know, there's going to be all kinds of confusion.
As a Taiwanese American, I wonder a lot, you know, what is Taiwan, and what does it mean to be Taiwanese? I feel a lot of times there's kind of this conflict between wanting to have a consistent message, but also wanting to allow Taiwanese people to speak for themselves, have a diversity of opinions, and to just, you know, project what types of stories they want to tell and not be gatekept and not be censored. So is there a way that we can kind of balance those two needs? Is it something that just has to happen throughout time? Or is there some sort of way to balance that?
Well, I would say, you know, you've hit the nail on the head. Diversity. That is the message, you know, that do you need to have a single representation of Taiwan? Do you need to be able to define what Taiwan is and its identity? You know, if people say to me, what is it about being English? I don't know where to start. I don't know what that is. And I know certainly Americans, you know, it's about diversity and, you know, the long story about the melting pot and everything else. You know, I think diversity itself is a very good starting point. You know, and I think that obviously, you know, you can have that narrative at a political level, which is consistent about we are not the PRC. We are, you know, a vibrant liberal democracy. These are our core values, you know, about civil society, free media, freedom of speech, you know, and all of those kind of things. But when it comes to more identity and culture, then we are a diverse society. And isn't that something that we're celebrating rather than wringing our hair trying to figure out who we are and what we are?
Yeah, I agree. I was just at a documentary film pitching forum here in Taiwan, and it's for Chinese language documentary films. So you had filmmakers from China and from Taiwan, from Singapore, and from the Chinese diaspora, and just, you know, filmmakers whose films are in Chinese or whose films touch on Chinese subjects or Chinese matters. And I thought it was really interesting because I think many of the stories from Taiwan were actually really diverse. You know, you had filmmakers that were talking about indigenous issues and class. Just the subject matter was definitely a lot more diverse. Whereas I think for Chinese filmmakers, they touch on class because I think that is a really major issue in China as well. But I think for the most part, you know, you don't see, you know, ethnic minorities in the films that they do. So I think in terms of diversity or diverse voices, I definitely think that is a strength in Taiwanese culture.
What do you think are some of the main challenges for Taiwan when expressing itself to a global audience? I think we've touched on a lot of them already, but if there's just any more that you'd like to share, and what could the government be doing to help, in particular in terms of media and cultural and creative industries?
I think, you know, for me, I feel like I was saying before, I think the government should just get out of the way. I think the government should provide infrastructure and encourage media literacy, encourage more investment into filmmaking and into the arts, and encourage, whether it's, you know, encouraging nonprofit organizations or private funders or private foundations or companies to create opportunities, to create funding apparatuses for filmmakers and for art creation and art perpetuation. I think that's the government's role, and not so much dictating or deciding on what media outlet to create or to fund or to start, or what MOUs to write up with what foreign or international media companies. I think I find that really troubling and problematic when a government starts to get into cultural perpetuation and cultural dissemination, because, you know, like Gary was saying before, it does become very propagandistic, and it gets in the way of different voices from being heard, and it gets in the way and it stifles creativity. So I think the government really should just get out of the way, but provide infrastructure and also encourage civil society to participate and to fund. And I think right now, for sure, I feel like working in Taiwan, funding and access to resources, because it's mostly controlled by the government, that is very challenging for filmmakers. So having access to resources so that we can tell the stories we want to tell in the ways we want to tell it, and not think that we have to write our scripts in a certain way to promote the country or promote a certain place or promote a certain administration. I think that that's always something that filmmakers are constantly grappling with. And I think that really stifles creativity. So yeah, I think the government needs to get out of the way.
Yes, certainly. I agree with that. I mean, looking at it from a more political perspective, I would say that, you know, the first thing is for Taiwan's cultural diplomacy, public diplomacy, don't think that you're going to change suddenly the geostrategic position of Taiwan. You know, that's beyond any public diplomacy campaign. You know, that's for the diplomats to be discussing. It's for interest groups and everybody else. Taiwan's public diplomacy is not going to shift the needle of a political opinion in places like America and the UK to suddenly recognize Taiwan as a geostrategic power. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, you know, as I've said many times before, don't try and compete with the PRC. Don't always frame your messages as a counter narrative to the PRC. You know, because all you're doing there is, firstly, you are amplifying their message. You know, they've said this, so therefore we're saying this in response. And I think that what Taiwan needs to do much more is just to be confident in its own messaging and just, you know, Let China do whatever it wants. We're Taiwan. We're not going to respond to that. You know, we'll have our own messaging about Taiwan and Taiwan's issues. Don't frame everything in terms of cross-strait relations. And I think there's always a danger of that Taiwan is always seen as China's neighbor. You know, it's always seen as part of this geostrategic triangle with the US and China, instead of just being Taiwan that's doing great things and on its own. You know, so that's another thing. I would also say, at the international level, making sure that all diplomats, embassies, ambassadors understand what public diplomacy and cultural diplomacy is, because I'm not convinced that they do, from my interaction with a lot of diplomats around the world. I mean, I hope they're not listening to this, but I had a bit of an argument with, several years ago, people in the Taipei representative office here in the UK, because they had a Facebook page about Taiwan in the UK. Which were they were posting in Chinese, and I'm saying, what is the purpose of this? Who is your audience? If you're trying to do public diplomacy in the UK, why are you posting things in Chinese that your main audience can't read? And you know, you're trying to get people more interested in Taiwan or whatever. So it's just these little things, you know, that I think Taiwan's diplomats need to understand that public diplomacy is central to all diplomats' job. You know, that everybody in the social media age is a public diplomat, and that they need to understand what it is they're doing and how they're doing it. And just these little things can make a huge difference. You know, I think that would be an important point to make as well. And also, if I could wave a magic wand, I would say, you know, bring back an equivalent of the government information office that is separate from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Because I think one of the biggest mistakes that Taiwan made was integrating or dissolving GIO and then putting public diplomacy into the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which hasn't worked out that well. And we've seen some of the mess that's been caused in the US when they dissolved the United States Information Agency and put it into the State Department. They're two different organizations doing two different things with two very different perspectives on diplomacy. So I've had that argument over the past, I don't know how many years. I know nothing is going to change. But I will still bang on that drum until the day I die.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today and giving all your opinions on these things. It's very interesting to hear your perspectives, and I got to indulge in asking a lot of questions that I've been thinking about as I've been trying to research Taiwan, think about Taiwanese identity, and think about how to promote Taiwan. So I'm very grateful for hearing your perspectives on these things.
No, thank you. It's been fun. I mean, really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Yeah, me too.
From our conversation today, it's evident that the Taiwanese government still has some work to do when it comes to providing adequate support and funding to Taiwanese creators. Thank you so much to Dr. Ronsley and Ms. Lee for joining us, and to you, our listeners, for tuning in. This podcast was made possible in part by the Taiwan Academy Spotlight Taiwan Grant. Production assistance is from Adrian Wu and Ben Levine. Thank you also to our staff and interns for your support in making this episode possible. Intro and background music is by I'm Difficult Wolsher Jicho Xiaonu. The Global Taiwan Institute is a 501c3 think tank located in Washington, D.C. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find information about our Global Taiwan Brief and our frequent public seminars. You can also listen to more episodes of Taiwan Salon on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever else you get your podcasts, as well as on our website's podcast page. Thank you for listening, and until next time.